Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Rick Doblin. Rick Doblin's the founder and current director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. Welcome, Rick.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Now, Rick, the purpose of your organization is to support researchers who are doing work in the field of psychedelic studies. And this actually has a history. It goes back at least 50 years. Can you tell us a little bit about a capsule of the history of psychedelic research?
Yeah. In a way, it goes back to William James back in the late 1890s or so, because he had done some experiments himself with nitrous oxide that he wrote about in the Varieties of Religious Experience, and he talked about it as helping him to see that there was different layers and veils, and that no account of consciousness was really complete unless you took account of all of these unusual states of consciousness. And he felt that he was a philosopher, he studied Hegel, he felt that under nitrous that he saw this synthesis of opposites in a more clear way than he had seen in other ways. And at that time, he could just think of the experiment, find the drug, find somebody that manufactured it, try it, all in the same afternoon. And now, more than 100 years later, we've got a situation where all the drugs are controlled, all of the contexts are controlled, you have to have approvals from probably 50 different people and 10 different agencies, and you have to have months and months of trying to get permission. So we've moved to this incredible situation where now we have these massive brain scan machines, we have incredible research methodologies to try to piece out what's going on, and yet at the same time we have all these restrictions. And just to go back, 1943, I think that's an important date for me. That was the first experience that Albert Hofmann had with LSD, and it was also in some of the dark days of World War II. And he developed, by accident, this substance that just took incredibly tiny amounts of it and just produced experiences that seemed like mimicking psychosis. He felt reborn. He felt like he was going to die. And it just opened up this floodgate of tremendous interest in how the biology of the brain. And so there was thousands of studies in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, both for understanding the mind, for psychotherapy, and then the whole nefarious undertone of chemical warfare, trying to develop drugs that would be used to discredit enemies, make them panic, truth serums. Whole underground stream was going on at the same time, and it was all bubbling up, and it was bringing people into, at Harvard here, having Timothy Leary coming to do research looking at whether these drugs can help people have religious experiences, people who are religiously inclined looking in a religious setting. And he was able to do an experiment in the chapel, Marsh Chapel at Boston University. On Good Friday, the person who was giving the sermon, who church this was Martin Luther King's mentor, Reverend Howard Thurman. Incredible dynamic speaker. So it had gotten to that level, I would say, of acceptance in the culture, looking at psychedelics. And they were able to prove, I think successfully, that psilocybin really did help facilitate religious experience in people who are religiously inclined. That's incredible news that you can merge science and spirituality in that way in an experimental context. And he almost didn't get permission to do it, but he managed to pull it off. And Leary's other big experiment was trying the Concord Prison experiment, where he tried to see if these religious experiences, these mystical peak experiences, would have measurable behavioral change, and whether he could take people who were still inside prison before they were going to be paroled and work with them and help them have a couple of these experiences. It took just incredible courage. Leary and the graduate students from Harvard went inside a prison and took psilocybin with the prisoners behind bars without guards with guns, like protecting them in a sense. They were there. They took the drugs, some of them, with the prisoners. So it was just incredible what they were able to do.
But Leary's history subsequently was also contributed to part of the stigma of psychedelic research, his involvement with the counterculture, with the New Left, and his kind of devolution into more and more esoteric interests. Isn't he kind of a symbol for some of the researchers of precisely why they want to avoid this field of research?
Well, I think that's true, and I think that some of that's deserved and some of that is not deserved. The part where it's deserved, is that in the Good Friday experiment, I think he wanted the simple solution a little bit too much. He was really more focused on the cultural dynamics and also on somehow not really sticking to the rigorous requirements of science, but being willing to go more into the promoter role where the truth can be slippery and stretched a little bit. And so for the Good Friday experiment, somebody I found out during the interviews, I tracked them down after 25 years and tried to talk with everybody I could who was willing to talk to me who was in the experiment. There were only 20, and I pretty much identified about 17 of them and knew the other two, couldn't reach them. And so there's only one missing person, and they were willing to share with me that somebody had had a very difficult experience and had run out of the church and was running down the street, and they were trying to... That part sort of has been shared by Leary, but the fact that they had to inject this person with Thorazine, with a tranquilizer, that they thought that they had to do that and bring that person back into the chapel for the rest of the service. That was never reported. So the extremes, the powerful energies that they were dealing with, both for good and for ill, the struggles, you know, they didn't quite report the full range of it. And I think that really led people to jump in unprepared for the depth and the power and the struggle. You know, now we think of it as, you know, it's too easy. You know, drugs are, the psychedelics are this easy way. When back then, people who were, back then in the 60s, early 70s, people who were using psychedelics for personal growth were taking doses that were like five times what people take today, were really entering these existential crisis areas, and it was very difficult. And then in the Good Friday, in the Concord Prison experiment, he wanted to report that he had reduced recidivism, but he really didn't. And so he found a way to report it anyway. And that, I think, was really heartbreaking for me to discover. And that experiment, which was tremendously courageous and really did help some of the people, it just didn't really have an overall effect in reducing recidivism compared to control groups. And he presented it as if it was a great success. And so that destroyed the credibility. And then in 63, you know, he was kicked out of Harvard, Ram Dass was kicked out of Harvard, and they were off into the whole social aspects of psychedelics. And I think that, you know, a lot of people blame Leary for people who took LSD and they weren't prepared. And
LSD and the other psychedelics were made controlled substances in, what, 63, 64?
It threw out there. That was later, 66. Mm-hmm. And then the Controlled Substances Act of 1970 further criminalized others. MDMA in 1985. The emergency scheduling. The ironic thing is that the first move to make MDMA illegal was DEA placing it in emergency scheduling. So the very first move that they did was later determined in courts to be illegal. The DEA had violated procedure. They didn't have the authority to emergency schedule drugs. So the very touching of the law, the very first touching of the law in MDMA, the law was later shown to be illegal and revoked. But we're stuck with it right now. You know, these drugs locked away, so, and it's really difficult to get permission to do research, but it's not impossible.
So what led to the formation of MAPS?
Well, there was this vision in the MAPS I started in 1986, and what led to it was this clash where I was helping, it had started a prior nonprofit, Earth Metabolic Design, and what Debbie Harlow and Elise Agar and myself had started this to protect MDMA. We started it prior to any of the organized social efforts to criminalize it.
And which is otherwise known as ecstasy.
Yeah, but there was this underground stream of people committed to the value of psychedelics, to their use in therapy, to their potential in broadening consciousness and broadening people's emotional depth and trying to deal with the irrational. That's sort of the peak vision, I'd say, of the psychedelics with Ken Kesey. Yeah, and then that vision led some people to continue to be underground psychedelic therapists after all this research was shut down in the early 70s, really starting in the mid-60s. So for me, in 1971, taking LSD in 1972, really seeing this whole edifice shut down and deciding that kind of my revolutionary contribution was to be a draft resistor and also to try to work on psychedelics and develop them. So out of that, other people thought similarly. And so there was this stream of people that were working. And in the mid-70s, they started working therapeutically with MDMA. I found out about it in 1982. And it was just incredible, thousands of people, therapists all over the place. And it just seemed so precious, so incredible, and it was still legal. And so we founded this nonprofit to try to protect and have research when the inevitable contribution of this recreational use, which was added into the mix, that this therapeutic work had worked with about 500,000 doses from the mid-70s to the early 80s. It had leaked out of that community. Somebody had tried and saw tremendous financial opportunity to make money and also to do a lot of good with people. I think it was sincere. It was early cocaine dealers that wanted a different product, that felt that ecstasy would be something they could sell more pridefully, and I think justifiably that was the right decision there. So there was this then growing exposure of people to opportunities to purchase ecstasy and more of that in recreational settings, and that attracted the attention of the DEA. It was clear. So the people who were part of this underground psychedelic river saw this recreational use that was happening more above the radar. It was clear that there was going to be a confrontation. And so we organized a nonprofit to try to do research secret and just have it for later and try to keep a clamp on the media. And then finally, it was too much, and there started to be articles. And the DEA then, in July of 84, tried to put in the Federal Register. They wanted to make MDMA Schedule 1. So during that 30-day period, there's a comment period, and we gathered together various people who would be willing to sign their names, Lester Grinspoon at Harvard Medical School. We had others, and then I walked into Washington, D.C., the DEA office, and said, here's my petition. We want to have hearings, and we have lawyers. We'd gotten together lawyers. It was a big team, and we ran through that for a couple of years, but it was clear to me that we were going to lose, that we really eventually would be crushed, and that the only way through back would either be through legalization, which I didn't think would happen before we as a society did more medical research through the FDA. So the DEA hearings really went on till 88. We didn't really lose till 88, but we did win an initial victory in that the administrative law judge, after sitting through all these hearings and witnesses and evidence, decided that MDMA should be Schedule 3, meaning it should be available as a prescription drug. This was a decision in 1986. So we really won, but the DEA ignored the recommendation and just stuck it in Schedule 1. And then, again, they did that for rationale that was later thrown out by courts as violating the law. They did it again, second time. Finally, the third time, they got it right. And so we were stuck. But MAPS was started really as a psychedelic pharmaceutical company, sort of the people's pharmaceutical company, because it would be funded by, the vision was it would be funded by lots and lots of donors, members, and it would be a nonprofit pharmaceutical company, that we would develop MDMA, other psychedelics, marijuana. The way I wrote the charter was broad, things that affect consciousness in some way or another. And so the core idea was really MAPS as a pharmaceutical company, started in 86. And the first thing that we did is we had animal studies done with a dog and the rat, 28-day toxicity studies that are those studies that are required by FDA before you can do human research. And we opened up a drug master file for MDMA and started filing applications, all of which were rejected. Took until 1992 for the first application to give MDMA to humans was accepted, and now it's taken 9 years to get the first application for a therapeutic use accepted by the FDA. And, for all I know, it may take another 9 years before we get it approved as a prescription medicine.
I'm speaking with Dr. Rick Doblin. He's the founder and director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Rick, the field of psychedelic studies, as you say, has also been caught up with, since Leary and even before with William James, in the study of religious experience. And recently you've gained a very forceful spokesperson in Houston Smith, one of the writers about religion who's been very widely read, and his advocacy of entheogens, this field of entheogens. Has the field of entheogens grown in the field of religious studies parallel to the interests of people who were involved in clinical counseling and those kind of fields?
Actually, I would say that it's slightly different than that. And in an interesting way, because you said that we've recently gained the support or the interest of Houston Smith. And what's happened is that actually there's been this long-standing interest that he's had. And he was actually at the Good Friday Experiment, working with Tim Leary, working on the Good Friday Experiment. And it's just becoming something that he's more outspoken about now as he nears the end of his life when he wants to make some major contributions and major points. He's just written a book called Cleansing the Doors of Perception, which makes the argument for the validity of psychedelic-enhanced, psychedelic-catalyzed mystical experiences. He's written a lot of the great religions. He's sold 2 million copies of that. He's really esteemed in his field. But what's happening, I think, is the cultural willingness to bring this back to the fore. What happened during the 60s, it was like an emergence that was just very abrupt and powerful and ultimately uncontainable, and everything, you know, flew apart and the repression came down. And it was so over-repressed that this use of psychedelics, even out of the scientific laboratories, it was just knocked out. It was just this massive overreaction. And so there's this, but some underground streams continued, people continued developing. And so Houston Smith also, there was this massive effort by a lot of people to look at non-drug approaches. So that in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of people started looking at the near-death experience, at shamanism, at drumming, at music, massage, just all different, you know, particularly meditation, mostly was, you know, Eastern meditation and Zen Buddhism and even monastic lifestyle. People started looking at all different kinds of things to try to do non-drug ways of anchoring, integrating, and also to try to use those to expand with. And the culture over these last 20, 30 years has in general gotten much more aware of the extremes that we've taken death with, which used to be so out of our normal Western human experience in the funeral homes. And, you know, now we have more hospice centers and we have more family opportunities for people to die at home with their families. We've sort of lost some of the fear of death in our culture in a very important way. We've also lost some of the fear of birth. That when I was born, 1953, my father was not allowed in the delivery room. My father is a pediatrician, a doctor, and yet they had this idea that, you know, the father shouldn't be there. This is a medical procedure for the women, knock them out a lot of times. So birth even was too powerful. And so we now have birthing centers and people in our hospital right nearby here, they have a jacuzzi in the hospital room. There's all this kind of taking birth, death, we've now got, we're more comfortable with those things. We're more comfortable with people talking about near-death experiences. We're more comfortable with meditation. We've got, you know, the quintessential sort of American masculine football heroes, you know, do yoga to try to help them play professional football. So we as a culture have gotten, if you look at our media, all of the psychedelic visual influences that people have when they're tripping, that the way they've entered into the media, it's just amazing. People in all of our movies, even mainstream movies, we've done so much to take that psychedelic vision and figure out how to recreate it technologically. So that I think as a culture, and also in terms of religion, because now this idea of, you know, globalization, there's a little bit more awareness and contact with other cultures, and so we're aware that right in our heart, right in the heart of America, the Native Americans use peyote legally as part of their church services and as part of their religious spiritual practices. And there's Indians and Native populations in Brazil and all throughout the Amazon that use ayahuasca, a mixture of roots and leaves, as a tea, legal down there. There's ibogaine that's used legally in Gabon as a religious drug, and it's being used, it's a psychedelic drug being used to treat addicts. And so,
well, let me ask you a question about that, because one of the things that Timothy Leary, went back when I was tripping as a kid, that I read from Timothy Leary was his book, his rewriting of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and the concept of set and setting in there. And if you look at the historical and the anthropological evidence about the use of psychedelics, it's clear that they were generally surrounded by a great deal of ritual, a great deal of cultural expectation. They were not used in a recreational sense or for the kind of weekend warrior kind of activities that we might do today. So in that context, do you think that there needs to be a distinction made between the casual or recreational use of these powerful substances and a kind of clinical or religious use of the substances?
Well, what I would like to do may be a little bit surprising, but what I'd like to say is that the recreational use at raves of psychedelics, a lot of the recreational use of psychedelics in bars and dances and in group settings is expression of that deep hunger that people have for these kind of group ecstatic experiences. And that in other cultures, they have combined, they have spiritual, it's medical, you know, it's communal, it's dancing, it's there's a lot of different emotions. It's not just one thing or another, it's not just limited, so that this blurry line between what's therapy, what's recreation, what's spiritual, what's celebration. I mean, you can say some of them are just celebration, and just think about the close line between celebration and recreation. So what we have in our culture, we shouldn't condemn the recreational use. We shouldn't say it's only appropriate in clinical settings or religious settings. What we should say is that this urge that people are having, that I think a lot of young people really feel very spiritually connected to the rave movement, to the community, to the dances, to the staying up all night, particularly just think about the rituals of the rave, of being up at sunrise, of being in a place with a group through the night, of energizing, of dancing, of having nonverbal communication, of meeting people, and then having quiet places for talking and going back to join the rituals. And it's just, for many people, and for myself also, I'm aware, I've been blessed with having had some opportunities of those group settings that were just joyous and profound and had a spiritual dimension. And yet, as a culture, we've got laws that are so excessive that they're perverse. So the DEA in New Orleans tried to shut down some rave clubs, and what they tried to do is to say that any of the symbols of drug use should be illegal. They tried to bust it as a house where drug use is being conducted, like a crack house. They used the laws that were created against crack houses, the DEA, to try to shut down these clubs where people were dancing, and they scared some of the owners. They signed this agreement that they wouldn't have a series of things like glow sticks, anything that glows, couldn't have massage tables, couldn't have this, couldn't have that, couldn't have a lot of things. But the worst thing that they couldn't have is called a chill-out room, which is 15 degrees or less temperature between some other room. And all of the evidence shows that with MDMA, with those kind of rave events, the most important thing is not to overheat. Drink adequate fluid. Don't drink too much fluid, but drink adequate fluid, and to have a chill-out room to rest every now and again. So the DEA is requiring people who run these clubs not to have the things that are most likely to reduce harm, and they're wanting these situations to produce harm to justify the crackdown. In Illinois, if you're caught with 15 ecstasy pills right now, possession, not sales, first-time nonviolent offender, you get a mandatory minimum, no parole, 4 years in jail. It's just, again, more of this irrational scapegoating now coming on these drugs that can really help us deal with the irrational. So I think in the religious world, there's right now a recognition that people are moving to direct experience. They're not always wanting to sit in a pew or and be given a sermon, and that we need more, that is an important function, but we also need to open the door to direct experience, and that's where a lot of fundamentalists actually do kind of recognize that, that if you look at some of the revivals and things, people try to go for these direct experiences. And right now, there's a classic struggle in our society over the religious use. The religions in Brazil, the União do Vegetal and the Santo Daime that use ayahuasca, are legal there. They've set up branches in the United States, operated quietly for years. Branches were busted for importing the tea, and now they have the best lawyers, and we have massively referenced and, you know, front of the court briefs about religious freedom and whether these churches that are legal in Brazil should be allowed to set up in the United States. So it's a very live issue. We clearly have the religious use of the Native American church with peyote solidly enshrined in our laws, and there's no claims even by DEA that they're hurting themselves. There's scientific evidence now being generated that they're not hurting themselves in terms of neuropsychological problems from peyote. So the religious use of these substances looks pretty safe and should be allowed. So we are at a situation, I think, where Houston Smith, to go way back to the beginning of your question, you know, is seeing at what can he make, how can he make a contribution at this point? What of all of his works is he going to emphasize? And I just saw him speak at Harvard Divinity School and speak Boston University about the important role that psychedelics play in religious experience.
Let me ask you one final question. We've got a Bush administration, a new drug czar who's a troglodyte. We've got John Ashcroft, who is a civil libertarian nightmare. And the Bush administration is moving against the medical marijuana. The Clinton administration was a little bit more reticent, but still hostile to medical marijuana and the various state efforts to legalize medical marijuana. Is the medical marijuana fight going to be the thin edge of the fight, the cutting, the bleeding edge of this fight to acknowledge the therapeutic aspects of drugs and to win the rights for physicians to prescribe and researchers to do research?
It's part of it. I'd say that we need to make an important distinction here between psychedelics, which cure because they get you high, and then we deal with that altered state in an important way, and marijuana, which cures usually because it has some effect on your body. It has some effect on pain. It has some effect on appetite. So there are some people for whom marijuana is an antidepressant. So there are some mental aspects of the use of marijuana, but it's easier, I think, for people to think in terms of marijuana. It's just a drug. It affects your body. The idea that
it could also be a red herring for that consequence, because if we can isolate the medically and therapeutically active substances in marijuana, then it wouldn't be a drug anymore, and it would just be another it wouldn't be a psychoactive drug anymore. And
well, that's what's happening. It still may remain psychoactive, but there are companies that are trying to market the cannabinoids and extract them, and there's a company, GW Pharmaceuticals, that is growing really excellent pot and then making extracts out of them and then trying to deliver that in a aerosol system or a sublingual lozenge, where you get, it's more like herbal medicine. Now you get the cluster of cannabinoids and its synergistic effects. You don't just get, it really is a good, marijuana is also one of the forefront of herbal medicines. But I think that what's happening with Ashcroft and the rest, they are against medical marijuana because they feel that you know, delegitimizes their hysteria campaign against marijuana. But they're also against states usurping what they think is appropriate federal power. So that's really what they're doing, more than the message. The message that marijuana is medicine is really pretty well widespread, and the cannabinoid research is demonstrating that. And so what the federal government is doing is trying to just say states can't decide, this has to go through us. And so where I see MAPS's work right now is we're trying to really develop and get a license for a marijuana production facility for medical marijuana research, for FDA-approved research. And it's kind of like, there's a lot of people that have tried to get permission to grow hemp. They've not gotten it from the DEA. But I'm trying to get permission to grow marijuana. There is marijuana that's grown for research purposes at University of Mississippi under contract to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And that marijuana is very low quality. They don't really want to give it to you to look at benefits because they're supposed to be looking at risks. And I'm trying to work now with UMass Amherst Department of Plant and Soil Sciences. MAPS is trying to work with them. And we've been through a series of inspections by the Massachusetts State Department of Public Health. And so now we need to go to the DEA. And what we need to do is make this case that it's in the public interest to let there be a real source for pharmaceutical-grade marijuana.
Rick, I really support your work, and I hope that people will connect up with you. They can find you at www.maps.org. What does it take to become a member of MAPS?
Well, not just an interest and a relatively small amount of money. We have student low-income memberships for $20. If you're a prisoner in jail for drugs, we'll send you a membership for free. And we have memberships, for $35 and $50, and we sell books. And we have about 1,800 members, and we are pretty small. And now that we're starting really to get some opportunities with this development of MDMA, it's like a real new level for us. And I think that trying to make MDMA into a prescription medicine is maybe a $5 to $8 million process. And, we want to get some money from the government and foundations, but it doesn't start that way. And so, it's a relatively small number of people that are supporting MAPS, and we really would like to stress the need for us to grow. So if people are willing to become members, www.maps.org, and we have a lot of information on the website for free.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you very much for letting me go on and on.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.